Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Journalist George Packer has some harsh words for the years we've just lived through. 2001 through 2008 was a time of terror and of waste. A time when, he says, America was given the chance to move the world in a new direction, failed miserably, and responded by trying to change itself. In a new collection of essays and reported pieces published between 2001 and 2008, he offers a look back at the ways in which we sought to better understand the events of those years. The book is titled Interesting Times. George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. He joins me in the studio. You can join us by phone, by email. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. George Packer, it's good to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
You realize, of course, that this period is barely even over. So looking at the years between 2001 and 2008, isn't it too soon to look back to evaluate?
It's not too soon to look back, but it is too soon to call it an era that ended. I think you need decades to know where a historical era begins and ends. It took a long time to understand that 1929 until 1941 was an era. The same with the 60s, which began in 1963 and ended maybe in 1973 or 74. Yes, so much has continued that began in the first decade of the 21st century. The wars have continued. The domestic wars have continued, the ideological wars, the arguments over the prisoners in Guantanamo and over civil liberties have continued. And in a way, even though the economic crisis of the last couple of years seemed like the biggest thing since the Great Depression, you read the paper today and you feel that in a way our economy is going to be the same economy that we had not just in the last decade, but maybe for the last three decades, an economy driven by financial speculation and by Wall Street. They seem to have rebounded quite nicely and quickly, thank you. I still think, though, that the years between the morning of September 11th, 2001, and the night of November 4th, 2008 has a distinct feeling that did change with the election of Barack Obama. Something new began. Other things didn't end, but something new began. And so I've collected these pieces not to look back, but to give an account in real time of what those years were like, because that's what journalism can do.
If you assume that something new began with the election of Barack Obama, why is it that we here in Washington seem to be mired in the same old stuff?
I think for two reasons. One, because it's hard to see the extent of change while it's happening, and it may be that deeper changes that will take years to shake out, to become evident in legislation or in a new political language or in a new attitude among voters and their representatives, is going on now. We just can't see it because in Washington, everyone becomes so mired and immured in the day-to-day battles right now over health care reform. That's the first reason. But I think the second reason is because the change of administrations made a bigger change possible, but not inevitable. We have, I think, institutional problems, institutional failures that go back years, that have been years in the making. The erosion of institutions like Congress, like the media, like the executive, like universities, and like businesses and financial institutions, this is a long-term erosion. And the ability to address our core problems has eluded us for a long time. And a new president is not going to change that with a wave of the hand.
George Packery, he's a journalist writing for The New Yorker. He's gathered many of the essays into a new book titled Interesting Times. And, of course, that comes from that old Chinese proverb.
Yeah, which apparently is apocryphal. I'm sorry to hear that, because it should be a real Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. It suggests that quiet times, when you can kind of be left alone to live your life without worrying about the big issues and events happening, not just in your country, but 8,000 miles away, that all leaves you alone. My own feeling, though, is that there was a benefit to September 11th, 2001. Strange
Actually,
to say.
Actually, you said in an essay that you hoped that 9/11 was going to shake us out of the dream we were in. What did you mean?
I think maybe since the end of the Cold War, Americans had believed that we could be the sole superpower without really having much responsibility in the world and without being visited by the backlash or the desires and aspirations of the world, that we could kind of be left alone by history to pursue our private destinies, which were mainly the pursuit of economic well-being. And that was what the decade of the 90s was largely about. September 11th was a huge slap in the face from the world and from history, saying you are not exempt. You do not get a pass. You're part of the world. And in the months and even years right afterward, I think Americans actually opened themselves to the world in a way that hadn't happened for a long time. Oprah dedicated a show to Islam. Americans began reading about places whose names they could hardly pronounce, like Jalalabad and Fallujah. And for a while, at least, there seemed to be something that's very rare in this country, which is an end to our insularity and an understanding that whether we like it or not, we do have responsibilities and we have to understand other countries in which we are deeply engaged. That's one thing that war does.
And I was about to ask whether you think that openness, that understanding or willingness to perhaps look at ourselves somewhat differently ended when we went to war.
I think not going to war, but the nature of the wars we've been fighting has worn down and disenchanted the public. These seem like endless wars. They're wars without victories. They're wars without easily identified turning points. Instead, it seems like the same thing day after day, with global media playing a role in giving us the sense that Iraq was just a whole lot of car bombs and firefights, and that they had no real significance, that they were irrational, that we were mired in someone else's problems that we couldn't possibly begin to understand. And I think that that feeling has begun now to extend to what used to be the good war in Afghanistan. It's the nature of these insurgencies that has made Americans pretty skeptical of whether we should extend ourselves in this way. And yes, I think that plus economic trouble at home has pretty much closed down that period earlier in the decade when it seemed like we were readier to try to understand the ideas and experiences and politics of other countries, which, as I say, is something that for a superpower we're not very willing to do.
You also talk about the years right after September 11th as being kind of a golden age of American journalism.
I think so. Although a lot of people will never forgive the Washington Press Corps for its failures in the run-up to the Iraq War. And for some Americans, that was the American journalism after 9/11, and it failed. I would say on the foreign side of things, the reporting on the wars, the reporting on terrorism, and just an extension of reporting to other countries in a big way, not just in newspapers, but in magazines and books, produced a pretty incredible crop of pieces, some of them narrative pieces, some of them long narrative pieces that in a way, you know, replace fiction used to hold that central place in our culture of how do we understand the times we live in? People turn to novels. Well, people don't really turn to novels in that way anymore. I think for a short period, people turned to books like Ghost Wars by Steve Cole and The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright. And The Forever War by Dexter Filkins and other books to understand what are these times we're living in. And that is why I do think it was a kind of a golden age on the downward slope of journalism, because at the same time, we're seeing newspapers hollowed out, shutting down, and, you know, closing their foreign bureaus. We're seeing the network news, a shadow of its former self. And we're seeing cable news taking over in a way that doesn't seem all that interested in reporting.
As you talk about long form, I must insert the Kite Runner novel.
Yes, that's true.
That was just so powerful in those years, helping us understand. George Packer is with me. He's a journalist with The New Yorker magazine. Stay with us. And George Packer is with me. He's a journalist writing for The New Yorker. His new book is titled Interesting Times. I'm sure you know him from his prior book, The Assassin's Gate. Do join us, 800-433. Pardon me. 1-800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We're looking at the years that George Packer has framed, beginning September 11th, 2001, to the date of Barack Obama's election. We were talking just before the break about what's happened to journalism. And what's happened to journalism is that while you spent a number of years in Iraq writing many of these essays, you've had numerous closures, closing down of newspapers, shutting down of foreign bureaus so that fewer and fewer reports are coming in.
It's a strange coincidence of two things happening at once. As I said earlier, I think this generation of journalists, including war correspondents, showed that they were every bit the equal of the Vietnam generation and the World War II generation. And at the same time, the business model that supported them was collapsing under their feet. Mm. And so their news organizations back home were steadily whittling away at their ability to do what they were doing well and what I think the public wanted them to do, because there was a real hunger for news and understanding of what our soldiers were doing over there, who were they fighting, why were they fighting. And it sometimes does take more than 800 or 1,000 words or more than 2 or 3 minutes on the network news to explain that, which is why long-form journalism, which is possibly an endangered species, filled a very important void during those crucial years.
You actually supported the war in Iraq. More, you say, for strong emotional reasons than for global strategy. Once you learn, as the rest of us did, that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, did that change your mind?
It made me more skeptical of the claims of the Bush administration than I had been, which was already – I had already been skeptical, because I had begun to go to Iraq and to see how little what we were hearing about the war from Washington was borne out by what it looked like on the ground. But WMD was not my reason for supporting the war, as I did rather ambivalently in the months before it. I thought that we had a historic obligation to Iraqis, because we had gone to war once. We had left Saddam in power. We had imposed sanctions that was strangling that country. And we had kind of imagined that this could continue indefinitely, when obviously it couldn't, because sanctions were eroding and because Saddam had shown that he was capable of renewing himself over and over again and had not given up aggressive ambitions. So WMD was, you know, the...
Not your issue.
It was not my issue, but yeah, it was the issue that the administration used. And for that reason, Americans had every right to feel that they had been taken to war on a pretext that proved to be false.
Now, looking back, had Saddam Hussein been left in power, how do you think the landscape might be different?
I think we would be facing a really difficult problem in Iraq, because once Saddam died, we had his two sons waiting in line to take over, who were one of them at least as much of a sadistic figure as Saddam, that's Qusay, and the other a complete psychopath.
Well, on the other hand, there are those who argue that had Saddam been left in place, you wouldn't have had the kind of conflict we're now seeing
of
the world.
I think that's true in the short term, but Saddam planted the seeds of civil war in Iraq by playing sect against sect, ethnic group against ethnic group, and in the end, by turning his tribe into the ruling tribe in Iraq. There was not going to be any soft landing after Saddam. There would be a very messy, very violent aftermath that would probably spill over the borders anyway. So not to say that any of that makes the rationale and conduct of the war any better. It just says you can't have an easy solution to this. There was no easy solution.
On the other hand, you do say that you wish you had listened a little more closely to the anti-war voices.
I heard the loudest anti-war voices before the war. I went to anti-war rallies. I covered them. And I didn't like what I heard, because what I heard was essentially that this was a war for oil, which I don't think was true, or certainly not the whole truth. It was about many other things. And I heard nothing about Saddam and about the Iraqi people, who, once I was in Iraq, it turned out, had themselves been ambivalent, but many of them had decided this was the best possible of many bad futures for them, was to have Saddam overthrown from outside, because they understood that it had become impossible to do it from inside. So it was more complicated in Iraq than the anti-war movement wanted it to be. But it's true that in those months, there were more nuanced and considered arguments for opposing the war. I did listen to them. Just on the night of March 19th, 2003, I asked myself, where am I on this? Because I had been going back and forth for weeks and weeks. I finally decided I want this man to be overthrown. I want this regime out because I think it's a menace to its own people and to the region. And then I started going to Iraq, and it got a lot more complicated. And in the end, it took me a long time because you have to understand, once you're plunged into this experience of covering a war, you sort of stop asking yourself the basic question about what happened a year ago or 2 years ago. You're more focused on what people are living through now and the direction things are going and how it's going to end up. And so I have to say, in the Assassin's Gate, and I was criticized for this by some reviewers, I didn't ask the basic question, should we have done this or not? I didn't have that kind of historical perspective. I was too close to it. It was too much in the middle of the war.
And look at the mess we have now. Look at the mess that we must rebuild in Iraq if we ever get a chance to.
We're on our way out. I mean,
we're on our way out, but what are we leaving behind?
That is, it's really ironic because for all those years, critics of the Iraq War sort of pointed to Afghanistan and said, that's where we should be. And actually, that was also President Obama's position during the campaign.
Sure.
Now that we're leaving Iraq and we're going into Afghanistan in a big way, Iraq has almost become the good war. They've switched roles. You hear people like Secretary Gates talking about what might happen over the next 18 months in Afghanistan. The best case scenario is what's happened in Iraq over the last 2 years since the surge. That doesn't tell you how good things are in Iraq. It tells you how bad things are in Afghanistan.
And what I'm asking is, what happens to the people in Iraq on the ground? What happens to the people in Afghanistan on the ground after their countries have been decimated? Are we going to rebuild? Are you in favor of spending the billions or trillions of dollars it's going to take to make those societies whole again?
I've argued and written for our continuing obligation to Iraq. For example, in Interesting Times, there's a piece called Betrayed, which is about Iraqi interpreters who worked with the American military and American diplomats and risked their lives
and
were hung out to dry.
Absolutely.
And were left behind. And they are a kind of microcosm of the danger we have left the Iraqi people in, and I think our obligations are enormous. I don't think our appetite to fulfill them is enormous.
George Packer, every essay in this collection, you say, deals with the problem of idealism. What's the problem?
The problem with idealism is that good intentions lead to actions that have unintended consequences. Once you interfere in other people's lives, whether it's by taking on a humanitarian cause in Sierra Leone, as a Brooklyn prosthetics maker that I wrote about did many years ago in one of the essays in the book, or invading another country and replacing its regime, you become responsible and you cannot control the outcome because it's beyond your knowledge and understanding. That's not to say we shouldn't try to interfere when there's an absolutely urgent need and when there's a capability of making things better. It's just that we should be chastened. We should have our eyes open. We should understand how much it's going to be out of our control. So that's why idealism is not a simple thing. It's a problem.
But would you call the intentions of the Bush administration good intentions for going into Iraq?
At the top levels, I would say no. But I met so many officials and officers and soldiers and Marines who, whatever they thought of the original policy, were there and were working
so
with Iraqis.
So they were the idealists.
They were. And they're, in my book, The Assassin's Gate, I wrote about several of them, sort of at the mid-levels, army captains, junior State Department officials, for whom this was the great experience of their generation. This was their World War II. This was their Vietnam. They knew that.
But that doesn't make it right or idealistic.
You have to talk to them and spend a lot of time with them, as I did and as writing for The New Yorker allowed me to do, to understand how Iraq had gotten into their system, how meeting Iraqis, having counterparts in the Iraqi military or in, say, you know, a bureaucracy of the city of Baghdad, whatever they thought we were doing at the outset, that became their reason for continuing to work hard, to sweat it out, literally, in the heat of Baghdad. So a kind of idealism did set in, and it can't be discounted because it to do so is to not understand the motives of some of the people involved.
Would you say that that idealism began to become frustration once the casualties, the dismembered, the injured, those who were fighting came home and realized how little they had?
I think in a lot of cases that's absolutely true. They became frustrated with the Iraqis, who didn't seem able or willing to meet them halfway. They became frustrated with our own side, which was forever botching projects or failing to provide the support that they needed or changing course and simply not knowing what we were doing, which was so much the case throughout the war. So, yeah, the idealism was tested and in some ways, you know, overwhelmed by experience.
George Packer, he's a journalist writing for The New Yorker. His new book is a collection of essays titled Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Diane, and good morning, Mr. Packard. My comment is that they really should call this decade the Naughties by reference to all the naughty things that have happened. And I really feel that the political climate has become so polarized that things in Washington can't get done, and that trickles right down to the states and then right down to the cities. So it's really been a tough decade for the working class.
You bet. And calling it a decade for the naughties is a pretty benign way of putting it to my thinking. What do you think, George?
I think it's a great analysis of the decade. Rather than seeing our leaders come together to solve problems, which was possible after 9/11, because there really was a moment of national unity. Instead, the war on terror, the war in Iraq, the economy and everything else became fodder for politicization. And I really do blame the media a lot on this because I think the dominance of our media by opinion journalism, which is a result of cable news and the internet, has poisoned the air and made it almost impossible for Americans to get their information without heavy doses of a slant, which divides them into sort of increasingly extreme niches. This is something I found last year on the campaign trail. I have an essay in the book about Ohio during the campaign. And I went there to find out what is the white working class, which the caller mentioned the working class. I was interested in the white working class in Ohio. What do they think of Obama? And what I found was their thoughts about him were so influenced by what they had heard last night on either MSNBC or Fox News that they could repeat the sound bites of the anchors
word for word.
Word for word. They sounded like talking heads. And it seemed as if people didn't trust their own experience because we're all swimming in the same sea of rather poisonous and polarized media. And it has a place here at home, and it also has a role abroad. For example, Al Jazeera kind of does the same thing in the Middle East that I think Fox News does in this country. And that's why one of the themes of this book is that even though global media is making the world smaller and giving us all more of a kind of common shared experience of images and words, it's not making us more enlightened or informed. In fact, I think it's making the world a bit meaner.
A bit meaner in terms of outlook, judgment, the way we react to differing opinions and that sort of thing.
I think the growth of conspiracy thinking, a kind of political paranoia that seems all too common around the country and around the world, that so much bad information is out there that people can't tell it from good information. Yeah, all of this has not made the world a more thoughtful place.
The book is titled Interesting Times. George Packer is a journalist writing for The New Yorker. We'll take just a short break. More of your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Jeremy Scahill, who has broken many stories about the private military contractor Blackwater.
The reality is that U.S. taxpayers are now funding what is essentially a shadow army. And also the operations of these companies are often shrouded in secrecy and are very difficult to obtain information on by journalists and the U.S. Congress.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we'll go back to the phones. First to Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Henry. Your question, comment for George Packer.
Thank you, Diane, and thank you for having me on the show for a second here.
Surely.
What I'm going to try to get to here is something on a much bigger scale, a much grander scale. I'd like to see a journalist or a consortium of good journalists get together and do some very deep research and investigation and bring to the public not the small picture that everyone tries to make us focus on so that we miss the big picture, but instead create an atlas, a flow chart, a compendium, a giant tree of names of the, not just, we know about the president, we know about the senators and congressmen and stuff like that. We don't know who feeds them the money and why. We don't know on a large scale how the shill system works. You call them opinionated journalists. I call them shills. They're
working for somebody and are producing results for somebody in order to steer public opinion either away from the truth or towards something else, which may be a diversion to keep people from learning the facts. And in the memory of Upton Sinclair, who was able to go in and open the closet up and show America the truth about what was really happening, and he did name names and was probably in fear for his life part of the time from doing it, that same thing needs to happen again, but on an even bigger scale.
Very thoughtful suggestion, George Packer.
I like your idea a lot. And what you're getting at, I think, is what's happened to journalism maybe over the last 20 or 30 years, political journalism especially, is it's kind of become a form of entertainment news. We cover politics the way we cover Hollywood, which is to say it's or sports for that matter. It's about who's up and who's down. What's the backstory and the personal life of this or that public figure? Who's in good favor and who's in bad favor right now with the powers that be in Washington? Instead of covering facts that can actually be verified and can, you know, you can almost get your hands on. And those facts are often outside Washington. They're in the country. They're in the lives that people are living in the country, whereas Washington journalism is famously relentlessly focused on Washington, which can become a kind of hall of mirrors. And it's that was one of the reasons, I think, why the Bush administration was able to bring the Washington Press Corps along with its WMD argument, with a few notable exceptions, because everyone was struggling for access. The key to the game was to get access to the highest players, but the highest players were not necessarily the ones who were going to tell you the truth.
And don't forget Judith Miller, the New York Times, who did have access, who, whether she understood fully or not what she was up to have that front page story on WMD.
But the other point the caller was making was that there's a whole world of journalists now, except they're not really journalists. They are talkers who are listened to by millions of people in this country and around the world. And it's as if with all the new news sources on the internet and on cable TV, we have become more confused than ever about what is real and what is not. And people find their own reality, so that different Americans are dealing from a completely different set of facts when they're arguing about politics. You know, Walter Cronkite died this year, but you could say Walter Cronkite died a long time ago. There has not been, since maybe I was a kid in the 60s, a few voices that were broadly trusted by the mass of Americans to tell them the truth. And the disappearance of the Walter Cronkites of the media has left the field open to the Sean Hannitys of the media, who don't even pretend to be dealing in fair, objective assessment of the news, but instead are pushing a line. And it seems as if people who still want to follow politics are drawn almost, maybe even against their will, magnetically to those shows. I watch them at night, partly because I want to know what's being said on cable news that my fellow Americans are listening to and being influenced by. And I have to say, it doesn't make me very hopeful for the future of our democracy.
Let's go now to Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Mr. Packard. Interesting conversation. And I guess, given the previous callers, the gentleman from Jacksonville, I don't have much to comment on, but I was I am encouraged by Mr. Packer's comments about the failure of the media institution, but and the title of the book, Interesting Times, I find particularly right on, spot on. Because I think now more than ever, it is up to the individual The ability to think for yourself is more valuable than ever. I think that what you spoke of from the 90s and everybody in pursuit of the almighty dollar, I do want to say that I definitely hold the media responsible, because I look at it as their responsibility to watch over the political class. And the failure to do that is the reason why we have such a gullible populace now.
All right, Mike, thanks for calling. You know, this healthcare debate, if we can call it that, is sort of a perfect storm of how politics has come down to a set of knocking heads.
Well, it's always been that to some extent. I mean,
but it seems particularly tough.
I think you're right. I think
I heard one talking head on the air yesterday say this whole healthcare debate has been a hoax. The administration never wanted healthcare reform to begin with. They'll end up with nothing and claim victory, and that's what they wanted, nothing.
And that's the kind of commentary I earlier called paranoid conspiracy thinking, and it has become common currency, even in the halls of government, and that's an alarming thing. It's as if a kind of denialism has set in among people who are in positions of authority. Democracy has always been about the clash of interests. That goes back to the 18th century and the Federalist Papers. But what we seem to have, and I say again, it's a long-term process, is an institutional sclerosis, so that the ability to address and solve major problems is becoming almost impossible. If you look at the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, it was every bit as hard to get that passed as it seems to be to get health reform passed. And it involved horse trading.
Of course.
And it involved all the skills that Lyndon Johnson brought to the presidency, including threatening senators with consequences if they didn't go along.
Right.
I'm not quite sure why Senator Lieberman isn't being subjected to the LBJ treatment in the Senate right now. But nonetheless, that bill passed. And its passage was a huge transformation of American life. How many bills in the decades since 64 and 65, when Medicare was passed, have made it through Congress, through the lobbying process, through the scrutiny by the media, and through the clamor that seems to converge on these issues and make it hard for people even to think clearly and understand the facts? Very, very few.
So
that tells us something is wrong institutionally. It's not just a failure of individuals.
So if this gets through, and we're still questioning whether it's going to get through, if it does get through in whatever form, are you suggesting that's a step forward?
I think so. I think I said at the start of the show that the period from 2001 to 2008 didn't end, but something changed. I think what changed is the possibility of reform in this country and of a kind of critical view of ourselves that allows us to see our problems and address them. And if healthcare passes in some form, it would be a sign that major legislation is not a thing of the past, that Congress is still capable of taking action in spite of the best efforts of very well-paid lobbyists and corporations to stop it.
All right. To O'Fallon, Missouri. Good morning, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. Just a quick comment on something you'd said previously. Yes, there was a big coming together after the attack of September 2001, but the administration in place generally used that to direct enthusiasm towards invading a country that had nothing to do with the attack. But to my, I think the biggest poison in the well, so to speak, of the last decade is an almost irrational hatred of government. And I know people who educate their children in public schools, of course, use the interstate highway system, fly on aircraft that are directed by what used to be one of the most advanced air traffic control systems in the world, and they'll tell you that government can't do anything. And it's the biggest obstacle, I think, to real health reform, and it's based mainly on it's sort of the, you know, kind of a fringe part of the electorate that simply does not want. You know, you can trash any program by saying it's government control.
Sure. Well, but Jerry, you've got to also go back to the fact that Ronald Reagan said government is the problem, not the solution.
I think Jerry has just put his finger on something that may be at the very heart of what we're talking about here, which is institutional inability to address problems. And that is, there's been a sustained ideological assault on government and on the very idea that there's such a thing as the public good, and that the public good is government's responsibility, and that it ties us all together, as 9/11 briefly did and other crises in our history have done. And instead, we have a kind of conservative ideology that says we are all private beings pursuing our private ends, and government should simply get out of our way, when in fact that's hypocrisy. Because, for example, after 9/11, the airport security was taken over by the government from private companies. And in fact, the government has done a better job of securing the air than private companies were able to do. So it is a myth that government fails at everything it does. But it's a very powerful myth, because it's also true that in the last few decades, a large number of Americans have seen their living standards erode, and the government seems to have been unable to stop that. And so the argument that government is not on your side is a very powerful one, even for people who might be looking to government for some help.
George Packer of The New Yorker magazine. His new book is titled Interesting Times, Writings from a Turbulent Decade. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me on the
show. Sure.
Hey, I wanted to make the comments. What I told your screener is a little different, but because George has covered a lot of ground since I've been on hold. But I don't like the stigma of paranoid conspiracy theorists. We were lied to so much during the Bush administration. I think the Center for Public Integrity had chronicled 935 false statements that the administration spewed out between September 11th, 2001 and September 11th, 2003. And I was at the point where, you know, you're talking about what's real. How could I know what's real? All that was happening was I was being lied to continually over and over again. I can think of Donald Rumsfeld on Face the Nation, where he tried to accuse his hosts and the press of creating folklore that he had said that Saddam was a threat to national security. And then it was amazing, one of the hosts whips out a quote from him making exactly that statement, and all he could do was sit there and hem and haw. And the guests there, they gave him such deferential treatment. I mean, they treated him with kid gloves. These people were just liars.
Can I answer you just by saying this? The kind of thinking I'm talking about is not a response to is not a legitimate response to a pattern of deception. It's a willful response to plain facts that are denied over and over. For example, there are millions of Americans who believe that the president was not born in the United States and therefore is an unconstitutional president, in spite of the fact that his birth certificate has been put on the web, has been displayed by his campaign, that there's all kinds of evidence that he was born in Hawaii in 1961.
So is that conspiracy or ignorance?
It's a desire not to believe any fact that goes against your orientation, your worldview. And that is a dangerous trend, because it means there's no common ground on which we can agree and begin a rational discussion.
So has President Obama lived up to the promise that Americans had when they elected him?
Some of the expectations were wildly overblown, because he's one man in a system that itself is the problem. We have to give him some time. 10 months is a blink of the eye in the course of history. I think he's moving in the right direction on some issues. He's running into huge problems on others, which perhaps he himself underestimated. But it's way too soon to say that he hasn't fulfilled the hopes the American people had in him.
Journalist George Packer, his new book is titled Interesting Times. He's also the author of The Assassin's Gate. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.